You had one of the best financial team a government could have. You were there. Montek Singh Ahluwalia was there. How did this team get assembled?
Whenever we went to US, for example, to raise resources, the lenders used to ask the question, you have so much gold in your, as part of your reserves. Why don't you use that if you want to raise a resource?
He devalued the currency consecutively in very successive days. And Mr. P.V. Narasimha Rao almost said that he had a collapse.
First half of the 50 years of the 20th century, the average annual growth rate of India was 0.89%. And at that time, population was growing at 0.84%. Therefore, per capita income almost remained stagnant over my decades. Well, they did many other things, like the railway, established a good administrative system, the judicial system was established. But their whole objective was not to improve the country as such.
Yes. How was the Tamil Nadu partition, that, if you remember?
The definition for a developed country is one is a country which has a per capita income of at least $13,000. India's per capita income today is about $2,700. So we have to really increase the per capita income by 5 times in order to become a developed country.
How was Mr. Manmohan Singh as a finance minister and as a prime minister? This is Siddharth Ahluwalia. Welcome to the Neon Show. Today, I have a very, very special guest. Someone who has laid the railroads of Indian economy. Someone who has played a large part in building the Indian economy as we see today. I welcome Dr. Chakravarti Rangarajan, one of the leading economists and policy makers of India, former member of parliament, the 19th governor of Reserve Bank of India. He's also the former chairman of Prime Minister's Economic Advisory Council. He's the chairman of Madras School of Economics, former president of Indian Statistical Institute, and I can go on and on with his honorary titles. So welcome to the Neon Show.
Thank you. So grateful
and thankful to have you today with us.
Thank you very much.
Today, we are going to discuss about your book, Fox in the Road. I have been amazed reading this book. It's seminal, you know, how much of India that we see today in 2024, the groundwork of it was laid back in 1990s, almost 34 years ago. And the role that you played in building the India of today. First of all, thank you so much for building the culture of our economic fabric of India, sir.
Thank you again.
Would love to first get into the few stories of that era. The first one is, what was the BOP crisis or balance of payment crisis that led to the economic reforms of 1991?
The crisis essentially was a rise in the current account deficit of the country and the inability to bridge that gap. We were not able to raise adequate resources to cover that gap. And therefore, we were in a situation in which our reserves were inadequate, totally inadequate, and we had to face an acute situation in which the imports had to be curtailed to a very large extent, and that had a very bad effect on the economy. What happened was in the 1980s, the economy grew well, but that was also marked by a situation of high current account deficit and high fiscal deficit. Economists will say that the two are interrelated. And as a consequence of that, we faced a situation in which we had to raise resources to fill the gap and also bring about a change in the whole economic system so that we do not get back into such a situation. So the reforms came as a consequence of the grim situation that we faced at that time, and to introduce measures aimed at both stabilization and reform. Stabilization was required because we need to correct the situation that we were facing immediately, then followed by a series of measures which will create a situation in which the economy can grow strongly but will not face the kind of situation we faced in 1990 and 1991.
So for our audience who are more new to these terms. The current account deficit for them, I would put in a layman's language, is the amount that we owe to international agencies for our imports. That would be the right?
No, that is not a total description. Very simply, the current account deficit essentially means a situation in which we are importing more than we are exporting. Therefore, there is a gap between the imports and the exports. And this is not being met by any inflow of resources adequately to fill the gap. Therefore, it's a combination in a sense of the difficulty in both the gap and the inability to finance it. But the current account deficit is basically the difference between the import of goods and services and the export of goods and services. If the export of goods and services is higher than the import of goods and services, we have a surplus on the current account. But on the other hand, if the imports of goods and services are higher than the export of goods and services, we have a deficit.
And what led to a situation that we didn't have enough resources to pay for this deficit during the 1990s?
Well, how exactly is this deficit met? The deficit is met in a number of ways. But for example, if foreigners invest in India, then they bring resources and therefore that fills the gap. Or if the foreigners invest in our stock market, then they bring resources, that also fills the gap. Or if we borrow, if the country borrows or the citizens borrow, then money also comes from, or the resources come from outside, and that is also a way of filling the gap. So borrowing either by the government or from the market or from banks or international agencies, plus the investment in India or investment in what we call portfolio investment in stocks and shares, all these are the resources that come from and fill the gap between the two. If it is still not met, then if you have reserves, that we can draw on the reserves and meet the gap.
And for our audience, I would like to say that in the beginning, 40 years since independence, we were a socialist state. It was not a fault of the government or the policymakers. They saw Soviet Union as an ideal, that what a developing economy or underdeveloped economy could follow. And thereby, India followed a socialism model where everything was owned by the state. And this led to the disasters of 1980s and the initial 1990s, when you were brought as a leader, as a team to solve it.
Yes, I think what we decided was that we need to make a break with the past. The break with the past happened in three important ways. One was to dismantle the large network of permits, controls, and licenses, and free, so to say, the market to decide where to set up a company, what to produce, how to produce, and all of that. Earlier on, under a strict planning regime, these were decisions actually taken by the planners or the government and passed on. Therefore, in some sense, the first thing was really to move away from controls. The second is also to define the role of the state in a better way. Earlier on, the idea was that it was government which must come in and do everything. That idea was given up or modified. While we recognize the role of the government or the state in economic activity, we did not think that it is the role of the state to take over everything on its shoulders and do it. That is the second one. Third one was, earlier on we followed a policy of import substitution in the sense that whatever we are importing, we should produce. But that resulted essentially in a high-cost economy. Because if we were able to produce that commodity economically and efficiently, then we would not have imported. So the reason why we imported was that it was cheaper to buy it from outside. So this process of import substitution earlier on essentially meant that we became a high-cost economy. We abandoned that idea. We moved away from that and said, well, we are going to become part of the world trade. We will compete and try to show that we can do things efficiently. That is why we dismantled the high tariff system, because the protection was given to domestic industry by levying a big import duty, heavy import duty. So the import duties were brought down. And sometimes we also simply banned the import of certain items so that they can be produced in India. To a very large extent, we dismantled the physical controls on imports. But there were still some on which we continued, and most importantly, automobile. I mean, even today, I think we are very reluctant to import automobiles from outside. And we impose such a heavy import duty that it is not possible for any normal person to import the automobile. But the basic point is we moved away from high import duties and dependence on controls. So this actually created a situation in which we will move on towards the production of commodities efficiently and economically. And in that particular process, we would be able to really set up a situation in which we can compete effectively with the rest of the world.
And sir, in the balance of payment, right, you mentioned in your book that we were just on the verge of default. So my question is, who was the default that we owed to? We were doing the default.
See, default essentially means in this, we have borrowed. We have borrowed from international agencies like the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, and others. Our people, our entrepreneurs and our businesses have also borrowed from outside.
Yes.
That was not that much at that time. I mean, I think that I forgot to mention in answer to your earlier question, the other important thing that we did as part of the transformation was essentially to allow foreigners to invest in India more freely than before, and also bring in resources from outside to invest in our stocks and in our stock exchanges. These were not permitted prior to 1991, and it was in a very, very limited way. So similarly, I think therefore this is the way in which we try to expand the inflow of resources and at the same time reduce the current account deficit.
So it's a very interesting story that to meet this default, IMF was putting pressure on you and the entire government to sell its gold, India's gold.
Well, it is not correct to put it that way. Okay. It is not IMF which forced us to do that. So, let me say another thing. We never sold gold. We only sent out gold to be used as a security against which we borrowed. And as soon as we repaid that thing, the gold became ours. There was no idea at any time to sell gold.
Yes.
Only to pledge gold, and the pledge of gold borrow money. So I think I can tell you, I was so much involved in it, I can tell you the story.
Absolutely.
Yeah. The point is that when we were faced with a difficult situation, we had a high current account deficit, and we wanted to fill the gap. Therefore, we wanted to go and raise resources. Whenever we went to US, for example, to raise resources, people used to ask the question. I mean, you know, people means the lenders, the lending institutions used to ask the question. You have so much gold as part of your reserves. Why don't you use that if you want to raise resources? So this became a kind of repeated statement that we were hearing. Therefore, we thought that the only way into way in which by we can reassure those people and raise resources from them was really to do something on our part. But as you know, that doing anything with gold has so many emotional implications.
Yes.
And it is not easy to make the people realize that we had to do it. But I believe that it is the shipping of the gold that really brought home to the people the gravity of the situation in which we were placed. Until then, they didn't know. They thought, yeah, there is current account deficit. These people talk about these things. And they didn't realize the impact of it. When we really shipped gold in order to raise resources, then they realized that how bad a situation in which we were placed. But the point is that the idea of pledging gold did not necessarily emanate from IMF. We had ourselves thought of that. And first of all, what we did was that the gold that we had in the reserves of the Reserve Bank of India were not valued at market price. They were valued at their original price. So first thing we did was to value it at market price so that to indicate the quantum of gold reserves that we had. Second, we decided to do it. But then these reserves were part of the balance sheet of the Reserve Bank of India. These gold was not in the hands of the government. So if the Reserve Bank had to raise resources and against the pledge of gold, that is possible under the RBI Act only with another central bank. RBI cannot borrow generally. RBI can borrow only from a central bank. Therefore, we contacted the central banks. Governor Rangaratnam and I at that particular time went around and tried to knock at every door that is willing to open and try to see what we can do. And then we found out that the Bank of England and Bank of Japan were willing to give us a loan. But then they insisted that the gold should come out of India.
Okay.
So we were saying, we have the gold, against the pledge of gold, give us the loan. But they insisted that the gold should come out of India. So that put the real issue of whether we ship the gold from India or not. We had no option at that time. So we shipped gold to Britain, to England, and then against that it was done. But the book describes about the various problems that we had in shipping the gold.
It started within the Chandrasekhar government, and then the government changed. P.V. Narasimha Rao and Manmohan Singh came in.
Yeah, the permission to ship gold was given by the Chandrasekhar government, and but the actual shipping happened, at least the greater part of it happened only after the new government of Narasimha Rao and Manmohan Singh took over. But Narasimha Rao and Manmohan Singh did not raise any issue. And therefore we shipped gold, but we have to charter a flight because the ordinary airlines refused to take gold because they thought it was very risky. And therefore we had to charter a flight, and it went. And the story ended well because it reached there. Against the pledge of gold, we had something like 500 million or little less than that of dollars, resources from both the central banks. But then, since we took all the actions which I mentioned earlier, within about 6 or 7 months, we were able to raise other resources and therefore return this loan. And the gold came back to us, and we have kept the gold outside India because we thought that for any eventuality we can do it, because there is also system prevalent in many parts of the world to loan gold also. In which case, we are the lender, okay. not the borrower. So I think, in a sense, we kept it, but we have not done that. But the point is, the gold was redeemed very quickly, within 6 or 7 months. And but that is a very drastic action, which had to be taken to reassure the people that we are willing to do anything in order to meet the crisis.
And I think at that point of time, the role of Reserve Bank of India was also changing. Yeah. It was getting more empowered at that point in time. Can you describe how the role of Reserve Bank of India has changed, like before you came in and during your tenure?
Well, the point is that these powers were with the Reserve Bank all the time. The RBI Act gave these powers. But the point really, one big issue was the relationship between the Reserve Bank and the
government.
And this is what many people talk about, the autonomy of the central bank, independence of the central bank, and so on and so forth. The one major decision which was taken and implemented was regarding the way in which the government obtained resources from the Reserve Bank of India. There was a system of the government issuing what is called ad hoc treasury bills in favor of the Reserve Bank, and against that to get money into the coffers of the government. So this system prevailed for a long time, and because of an agreement between the government and the Reserve Bank of India. I took up this issue, and fortunately, Dr. Manmohan Singh, who had also been previously a governor of the Reserve Bank, agreed, and we revoked the earlier agreement in two steps, and therefore the government cannot automatically now get money. I mean, I think there are other mechanisms to get money, but it has to be gone through. Whereas in the other method, simply issue the ad hoc treasury bills in favor of the Reserve Bank and then get the money. So that is a very important way by which the Reserve Bank of India assumed certain independence from the government. Therefore, even now, for example, that when government needed resources, revenues were falling, but expenditures have increased, and therefore they needed more resources. Even then, at that time, they did not resort to the direct method. The Reserve Bank of India, in its wisdom, also decided that more liquidity should be provided in the system. So they provided more liquidity. Therefore, the banks had more reserves, the commercial banks, the public sector commercial banks, and as well as others. And as a result of it, they were able to contribute to the bonds floated by the government. Therefore, in a sense, that essentially means that there is no automatic monetization of the deficit, of the fiscal deficit. It has to be an arrangement between the Reserve Bank and the government. So that is an important step that followed and made the Reserve Bank of India a different institution. The other important thing that happened was the modification of the exchange system that prevailed. Previously, the exchange rate of that is the value of the rupee in terms of the foreign currency, was determined by the Reserve Bank on every working day. And this is... therefore, the exchange rate was not determined by in the market, so to say. And therefore, when we moved away from, moved to a more free trade regime and so on, and allowed others to invest in India, both in real investment as well as in stock market, we decided that we should also move towards a market-determined exchange rate system. And that also transformed in a big way the way the Reserve Bank of India was dealing with the exchange rate of the rupee. So that's another major change that happened. It went through two stages. Finally, we went to a system of what I would call more or less market-determined exchange rate system.
Got it.
I am using the word more or less because we recognize from the beginning there may be occasions when the Reserve Bank of India may have to intervene in the market in terms of reducing the volatility or in terms of reducing the rapidity with which the value of the rupee was changing. Therefore, we recognize the fact that it may be become necessary or for the Reserve Bank of India to do it, and therefore we did that. So this is another important change. And the third is, of course, about banking reforms. I mean, people have been talking about banking reforms earlier also. Actually, 1969 was a very important milestone in banking development in our country when the major private sector banks were nationalized. But as the functioning of the banking system evolved, we found out that it is necessary that we have to improve the safety and soundness of the banking system, and therefore we need to introduce what we call prudential norms, which must be conformed to by all banks, so that banks are solvent, safe, and secure. I think this is one of the important things because, as you know, that the 1969 nationalization was essentially to correct a situation in which the credit flow was confined only to a limited set of people. We thought that it was thought at that time that we need to change that pattern. This is what we call allocative efficiency. So the efficiency in terms of allocation of resources for credit. The second change, big change that happened in 1999, is about operational efficiency. If the banks ought to function as efficient institutions, then they must be, and they have to, so to say, regulate industry. Yes. And so on. They must be efficient. Physician, heal thyself. Therefore, it is important that they are efficient. So therefore, we introduce a set of rules and so on and so forth. So in some sense, as I, to conclude this part, I want to say that the Reserve Bank of India during this period acquired more and more powers to regulate the banking system, even to regulate the behavior between the government. Yes. and the Reserve Bank and also, as I mentioned, about the exchange rate system. So these are some significant changes that happened during that period. They have been carried forward because the almost in a sense that the markets have become more complicated, more complex now than they were even in the early 1990s, and they had to be handled as they evolved.
And a very important step that you took as a governor, and I believe you were a very new governor back then. You had just, I think, gone from a post of deputy governor to governor, that you devalued the currency consecutively in very successive days, right? And Mr. P.V. Narasimha Rao almost said that he had a collapse during that. Would love to know that story.
See, the point is that
why did you do it?
Actually, we are going back because this was the beginning of the changes that we were introduced. Actually, the devaluation happened before shipping of gold, actually. And the devaluation was also, yes, one of the steps that we have to take to reaffirm and to make the others, the lenders abroad, to feel that we are taking all actions that are required in order to correct the situation. Devaluation is always regarded as one way of curtailing imports and encouraging exports.
Yes.
And that is the reason why you devalue the currency. The imports become more costly. Therefore, there is a reduction in imports. And exports become more attractive as a consequence of devaluation. Per dollar, you get more rupees. And therefore, as a consequence, it encourages exports. Therefore, this is what is normally thought of as an appropriate measure in terms of encouraging, in terms of correcting the current account deficit. So we had to do it. And we are also to decide on the extent of devaluation, because the devaluation is of a small magnitude, then it doesn't bother too much. But if it is significant, that is what we had to do. And this we thought we should do it in two installments, because we wanted to see, for example, what the reaction is after the first devaluation and then follow it up. Another important thing which many people may not have noted, but I have indicated in the book, is this devaluation of the rupee was not done by the government. It was done by the Reserve Bank. The Reserve Bank did it in a very interesting way. As I mentioned to you earlier, the Reserve Bank determined the exchange rate of the rupee
Yes.
every day. So in the process of determining the exchange rate of the rupee, one morning I suddenly announced a steep fall in the value of the rupee. So it did shake the market, because the market was not expecting
prepared for it.
Anything like that. And we felt that we should go ahead, because that is not enough. So we went two or three days later and did that. It was at that time there was some feeling in Delhi, because this was not happening in Delhi. This is happening in
Bombay. Yes.
There was some concern about whether this is appropriate, whether we are going too far and all that. But I was anyway cut off from there, and therefore on the appointed day, I went ahead and did it. But then Dr. Manmohan Singh called me, and then I said, yes, I have used the word, I have jumped. So I had jumped, I had taken the second step, and the devaluation.
I remember hip, scop, and hip, scop and jump.
Yes, skip, hop, no, hop. Skip and jump.
Hop, skip and jump that you mentioned in the book.
So that's what we did. So.
And you mentioned you were always like almost absconding because it was a minority government at that point in time, right? And
no, not only that, I think devaluation is always a controversial issue.
Yes.
And the extent of devaluation is also a controversial issue. How much should you do in order to correct the
Yes.
disequilibrium that is prevalent. So we had decided at the meeting in Delhi, it was not done by a Reserve Bank without the permission of
Yes.
the government. On the exchange rate, the government has also an important role to play. We met, it was decided, this is what we should do, and we should do it in two steps. Whatever concerns that were expressed was lay after the decision had been taken. But anyway, I think it happened to me to be the person to do it, and I did it.
And so, now before continuing on the journey that you mentioned in the book, I would like to go into your childhood, right? Do you remember, the place that you grew up in before partition, right? Some memories of that place and your childhood.
Well, in some sense that when India gained independence, I had just finished school. So bulk of my school career was when India was under the British.
And which city you were in?
The British rule. I cannot talk of a city because my father was in judicial service.
Yes.
and being a transferable job, we moved from one place to another place. Believe it or not, I studied in 5 different schools.
Okay.
And it had an advantage. I saw diversity, but it had a disadvantage that every time I had to go acquire new friends and get adjusted to your new environment. But that was it. But the whole point is that those who were part of the government service at that time were also in a difficult situation. It is not that they did not realize that we need to get away from the British rule, but they were part of the government, like my father. So it was a very uneasy feeling they all had, and that got reflected in my house also. Yeah. I mean, I think I remember not always my father being happy about everything that was going on. But that was it. I think the point is that when you look back, I have in the last chapter of my book also indicated that the first half of the 50 years of the 20th century, that is between 1900 and 1950, the record of the British rule was dismal. Between 1900 and 1950, the average annual growth rate of India was 0.89%. That is less than 1%. And at that time, population was growing at 0.84%. Therefore, per capita income almost remained stagnant over the 5 decades. Well, they did many other things which may be good. They laid the railways, they established a good administrative system, the judicial system was established, and all that. But their whole objective was not to improve the country as such, yes, but only to really run the administration and to an extent possible transfer as much of the resources from India to England. I mean, I think this is what it was. The point really is that the British rule did a good job in terms of law and order. I mean, I think because that is their lifeblood, so to say. I mean, I think they depended on it, because it used to be said even the railways were laid only because of the desire to move the troops from one end to the other end. The taking the passengers came as a secondary,
yes,
consideration. So the point is that it is, I would say that as far as my livelihood is concerned, the childhood is concerned, it was comfortable and reasonably comfortable. And as I said, that one learned many things. There was an intellectual environment at home, I benefited from it, and I obviously did reasonably well in my studies, and that is it. But the point really is that on the British rule, there was such a big dilemma in the minds of the people, even those who were part of the government.
You said that you saw the turmoil in your own house. Right.
Yes.
As your father was part of the judicial services. Mm-hmm. And how was it after independence? Right. Did you feel a change in the house and subsequently your environment immediately?
I think so. I mean, I think there was a real change at the time, and I think many people of the really felt that the change has occurred, and we have now the freedom to mold India in the way in which we want. There was genuine joy and satisfaction at the time of independence. Therefore, that is the whole question later on was essentially how much debate there was and how much consultation there was and so on. But essentially, there was a big change in the environment and the atmosphere before the British rule and the post-British rule. And we got drawn into discussions about how to move the economy. And as you yourself mentioned it earlier, that if you want to grow fast, perhaps the best example is that of Soviet Union.
Yes.
But Soviet Union was also not, but Soviet Union was never a democracy in that, in the true sense of the term. So to combine democracy with economic planning or nationwide economic planning was a new exercise. And that is where India struck a new path. And as we moved along, the point is at what point we should have made the change. The role of the state was well understood, because at the time of independence, there was no clear idea, even in the literature, regarding what should be done in order to grow fast. That literature was also growing at that time. Development economics was not well known at that time. Therefore, we had to experiment. But the core question is that, could you have changed direction, or could you have modified, not changed direction fully, but modified the direction? I think that is where I think perhaps we slipped a little bit.
Yeah.
Perhaps we could have at least done a decade earlier.
Yeah. Could India have been in position of Singapore or China? That's the real question.
Yeah. Well, that is, I mean, we had a problem of population which many other countries did not have. But the point really is that in the light of our own experience, what should we have done?
Yes.
Could we have changed a little earlier? Because the famous speech of Deng in China was in 1978, December 13, 1978, when he asked for new ideas and new ways of doing things. So even then, even at that point, we did not change. As compared to China, we were perhaps one decade behind in terms of reforms. So that's it. But on the other hand, the whole idea of democratic institutions, people exercising their rights, and all that, is a big change from the British time.
And, you know, you were also there when there was Tamil Nadu partition. Like, how was the Tamil Nadu partition, that, if you remember?
The Tamil Nadu partition is what? Between, you see, when I was studying and all that, and when my father was in the judicial service, we were then in the Madras Presidency, as it was called then. It comprised of some part of Kerala, some part of the whole of Tamil Nadu, the whole of Andhra Pradesh, and so on. So this was the big thing. So the first thing that came, this was before even the linguistic states were formed, was to separate Andhra from Tamil Nadu. So the moment democracy took root, language became an important issue, because if institutions are to be run by people and people speak a particular language, then that gains importance. Therefore, the language of the state assemblies became basically the language of that region. But multiple languages didn't seem to fit in with that. And therefore, the linguistic states are a natural consequence of the spread of democracy. That's the way I look at it. Therefore, the idea of partition of the old Madras Presidency into Andhra and Tamil Nadu became inevitable, because how long will, I mean, you know, given the size of, let's say, Tamil-speaking people and the Andhra, the Telugu-speaking people, if democracy holds good, if one language group is in majority, the chief minister will always be from that region. Therefore, this could not continue for long. And I think Tamil Nadu had a good administrative system, and that I think Tamil Nadu gained a lot because of the good administrative system that we had, and had very good industry ministers and chief ministers at that time, and which made Tamil Nadu progress quite fast.
And today Tamil Nadu has become the industrial hub of the South.
Yes.
All industries are coming from here. For example, for Tata, they left West Bengal because of communism and many other things and came to Tamil Nadu. Electric vehicle factories are getting set up in Tamil Nadu. Companies like Ola, which are Bangalore-based, Karnataka-based company, are coming here. So why do you think that it has suddenly become one of the most popular destinations within the country and for outsiders also to set up in Tamil Nadu?
I think the basically, what are the investors looking for? If it is becoming the destination of the investors, we need to look at that. So they want to come here, produce something which they have been producing elsewhere, but producing that thing efficiently. So they needed a good infrastructure, good skilled manpower, and so on. Therefore, in some sense, in all of these respects, Tamil Nadu is one of the states which has moved forward. The infrastructure in terms of roads, railways, availability of power, all of that has been on the agenda of the policy makers in this state for a long time. And therefore, it did create a situation in which all of this were available. I know of a time when power was a big issue in Tamil Nadu. It is not as if that it was not an issue here. But we have reached a stage at which the availability of physical infrastructure and social infrastructure like good colleges, good schools are also became available. Therefore, the main reason I think for many people coming, many investors seeking to come to Tamil Nadu is because of the sound administrative system and a physical and social infrastructure which is good.
And sir, there were new terms coined during your administration like NPA, FDI. They didn't, non-performing asset didn't exist.
Yes.
Before your time. Neither did foreign direct investment. How did you come up with these?
The term non-performing asset was not used prior to 1992 or something like that. But the idea of non-performing asset has been there in the other countries. And therefore, in some sense, the banking reforms that we introduced were also taking into account what was happening elsewhere in the world. For example, capital adequacy is what is very often called the Basel norm, because it is a Basel convention which introduced the idea that against the loans, the risky, risk-weighted loans, a certain percentage should be kept in the form of capital. So we introduced that also. For example, capital adequacy ratio, which we use now, came into vogue at that time because we thought of introducing. Non-performing asset is because the whole, prior to 93, what happened was that when payments due were not forthcoming from the borrowers, the lenders, which means the banks, did not necessarily classify them as non-performing or performing. They were all said, yes, it will come someday or sometime or something like that. But it is now, it is after the introduction of those norms of when a particular asset will be defined as when treated as non-performing. That is the 6 months, 9 months. I mean, it changed from time to time, and the period has been shortened from time to time. Then we could identify or call that as non-performing assets. So these terms like capital adequacy, non-performing assets, all came along with the reforms that we introduced. Yes. It is a consequence of the reforms introduced that these classifications became more well-known, and now people talk about, yes, are they adequately capitalized? How high is the, yes, non-performing loans? I mean, so on.
Yeah. So I would like to ask, right, you had one of the best teams during 92, the best financial team a government could have, and India has till now, right? You were there, Montek Singh Ahluwalia was there, and a couple of other folks, right? How did this team get assembled? And Mr. Manmohan Singh was also there as part of that team.
Well, I don't think it, it happened at a time when so many of us were involved with government. Somewhere around that time, it was decided that the government will also take in people from outside who are competent into the system. Essentially, the government was run by the bureaucrats, particularly the civil servants, the IAS officers, and other similar officers. But from time to time, they decided that it is good to get people from outside and make them part of the system. So what you have at that particular time, a mix of people who have come from outside at some particular point in time. So I had spent, for example, in academia for almost 20 years before I came into the Reserve Bank, and therefore part of the system. Similarly about Montek Ahluwalia, and there are many others, Shankaracharya and others. But there are also people from within the IAS who are also efficient and competent, and who could also do things like N.K. Singh or Mr. Geeta Krishnan and others. Therefore, it so happened at that time. There was a mix of people who had domain knowledge acquired outside and coming into the system, as well as people who are very competent in their own civil service and who could really contribute to it. And I think, I suppose, it's also part of the part of the management skills of the policy makers, I mean the political policy makers at the time, to recognize this and to bring the people.
Yeah. And if you could remember, right, how was Mr. Manmohan Singh as a finance minister and as a prime minister?
Well, I have known him in both respects. As finance minister, when he became finance minister, he had very little political experience directly. I mean, he has dealt with politicians because he has been in the government, and therefore dealing with politicians who are finance ministers or who are commerce ministers and so on and so forth. He was himself not in politics. Yeah. That was his first experience as a politician. But it is also true that he went in as a finance minister because of his technical capabilities and technical powers. It was a recognition of his capabilities as an economist, as a practicing economist, that brought him into the position of the finance minister. And then he delivered a very competent regime, and all these reforms could be introduced. We were part of the team, but he led the team, and in a sense that Narasimha Rao played the role of providing the political support to the new economic regime. So Narasimha Rao's role is also very important. And many people do not realize that Narasimha Rao at that time as Prime Minister was also Minister in charge of industries. And therefore the whole system of controls, licenses and all were knocked down by his ministry. There are many other things which were done for which Dr. Manmohan Singh was directly responsible. But the point essentially is that as finance minister, he functioned for most of the time as a technical expert. But he delivered. I mean, I think that is important. But as prime minister, by that time, he had not only been the finance minister for almost 5 years, but he was also the leader of the opposition in the Rajya Sabha. And therefore, as prime minister, he had by that time a lot of political skills also under his control, and that made the difference. But I think the most important thing as prime minister was that he was able to give a direction to the way the government is being run, not only from the technical angle of finance, but also from various other perspectives also, whether it is foreign policy or whether it is Jammu and Kashmir or whether it is something else besides finance, he was able to guide. And the first term of Manmohan Singh as Prime Minister showed that he can handle all of this, and really it led to a situation in which the country grew at a very fast rate and gained acceptance in all other areas also. The second term of his as finance as prime minister was slightly different, because that was a period beset with too many political problems.
Yeah, there were too many scandals happening left, right and center.
Yeah, and therefore it did not come up as well. But as finance minister, he did excellent job. As prime minister, he did excellent job in the first term. The second term was somewhat clouded by other factors.
Yeah, and I believe that if he had contested as a prime minister for the third time, the Congress government would have a fair chance in 2014. But he withdrew at that point of time that he doesn't want to be a prime minister again.
No, I don't think that is the situation at the end of 2014 was very different. I mean, I think because in any case, he did not stand for election,
yes,
even earlier, because he was always a member of the Rajya Sabha.
Yes.
So that is different. So in 2014, it is not the fact that he did not stand, because he did not stand for election even.
But it was clear that he would, if Congress wins, he would not be the PM. It's either somebody, Rahul Gandhi or somebody else, would have been the PM.
Well, I don't think it was made up that quickly, but it was made up that way. But the point really is, there were too many things which came into conflict at that time, and whether the Congress Party would have been able to clear them and get a chance, but. It was doubtful even at that time. It is not as if it was very clear that Congress will lose it or not. But the point was that there were problems in the second half, if I may say so, of the second term.
And you also decided to step back from active roles in 2014.
Yes. See, the point really is that by the time I had become chairman of the Economic Advisory Council and all that, and I was also deeply involved with the policy making.
Yes.
Therefore, there was a system change.
Yes, new guard.
And I don't think it was right on my part to continue. I mean, I don't think it's appropriate.
Yeah.
So I left. I mean, and I think that is the right thing to do.
But then it becomes the responsibility of the new government to tap into your rich experience of last 32 years. I don't know how they did it or how they were not able to do it. But I
really don't know. I mean, I think this is...
But because we were one of the very few people who spent 32 years in policy making.
Yeah, well, the point is that it all depends upon the synchronization of ideas also.
Yes. So you have contributed so much to India, like almost 32 years of your active life. What's your message to the young India that is right now in 2024? Where is India headed, and what do we want to give to them that take the baton forward from me?
In a sense that we have to set a new goal. Post-Russia-Ukraine war, post-Gaza war, we need to decide where we are heading and where we are moving. People talk a great deal about the fact that India is the fifth largest economy and it will move to be the third largest economy in the next few years and so on. That is true. I think we can be proud of that. But at the same time, we also have to remember that in terms of per capita income, India is almost 142 out of 197 countries. That shows the distance we have to travel. We talk about India becoming a developed country. What is a developed country? The definition that we normally use for a developed country is a country which has a per capita income of at least $13,000. India's per capita income today is about $2,700. So we have to really increase the per capita income income by five times in order to become the developed country. It is a good aspirational goal. I think we need to set that before us. It's good to do that. But we really need to understand also the problems that we will face, the challenges we have to meet. We really need to raise the investment rate in the country by another 2 or 3 percentage points. And we also have to reckon with the fact that the growth rate of the developed countries is going to somewhat be slower hereafter. OECD has almost said a secular decline in the growth rate of developed countries. And at the same time, we have problems about climate change, the need for reducing emissions and all that. It will essentially imply that the world as a whole cannot be growing at the rate at which it was growing in the past. If you have to reduce the emissions, you will have to reduce the production of certain output. Therefore, there are problems that lie ahead of us. I would really think that even though we may not achieve exactly the developed country status, we need to grow at least at about 7% per annum. And if the incremental capital output ratio is 5:1, then the investment rate has to be at 35%. I think that is one good goal to keep in mind. The second is really we have to deal with the technological changes that are happening. These technological changes are somewhat different in character from the technological changes that happened earlier. The AI, generic AI, and other things are essentially substituting not the manual labor, but even the intellectual labor. That imposes, that creates a situation in which the demand for human labor itself could go down. To put it in the language of the economists, the employment elasticity of income may come down. That is, for a given increase in income, you may need less people than before. Then that creates a conflict between employment growth and output growth. Previously, when there was output growth, there was automatically an employment growth. But that may be affected to some extent in the coming years. The third thing that we need to look at is also on which we should focus on which sector should we focus on. Some people say that South Korea and even China moved fast because they focused on exports. That is true. But that is no longer possible when even the developed countries are not going to grow fast. And the attitude in the developed countries is also changing in terms of free trade. They taught us about the advantages of free trade. Now they are making a retreat from that position. Therefore, the point is that the growth strategy hereafter will have to be multidimensional. It is not just manufacturers. It is not just services. It is not just exports. We need to be able to excel, or we need to be able to have control, ability to move into various areas, whether it is exports or manufacturers or services. That is why I say the strategy must be multidimensional, not like an earlier time saying that, look, exports will pull the country out and so on and so forth. So in this context, the challenge before the young people is very great. But the first thing that is essential is that we need to adapt our young people to the new technologies. We have to be the skill development. We cannot ignore. I think the new skills which are required must be inducted, and our people must be capable of handling the new technologies. Therefore, the young people should really do that. The second, of course, is efficiency, and efficiency in what way? I mean, I think we must be capable of not only adopting the technology, but also using it efficiently. That is where the skill again comes in. Therefore, the problem before us really, and therefore the problem before the young, because the next 20 years through which we have to go in order to achieve the status of a developed country, that responsibility lies on the shoulders of the young. And therefore they have to do it. And therefore they have to adapt themselves to the new technologies and the new environment in terms of production that is happening.
Thank you so much, sir. Yeah. I've been really grateful to have you today with us. I can't express how delighted I am to share the stage with you and share your message with our audience, right, who look up to you for what you have done for the country.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I also enjoyed the conversation with you.
Thank you so much, sir.